the people turn us down, Lord, in a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, gonna spread the news all around. Treated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bourgeois town. The bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, gonna spread the news all around. Well, me and my wife, we were standing upstairs. I heard a wise man say, I don't want no niggas up there, Lord, in a bourgeois town. Bourgeois town.
Good morning. We're back at you with Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. Be with you until 9 o'clock when Political Perspectives rolls around. And we're revisiting the issue of the Springwater Corridor and other related issues of housing and houselessness here in Portland, Oregon, with one guest that we had on a couple weeks ago talking about Springwater, Amanda Reese of Backpacks of Hope. Good morning. And we have Austin Rose of Portland Tenants United. We had his colleague Katie Berendt on that discussion a couple weeks ago. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning, Paul.
And we have Sarah Iannarone of an urban planning expert and community activist and former mayoral candidate. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
And we'll be talking about the Springwater issue. They are planning to go in and will almost certainly go in and evict whatever remaining residents are out there on the Springwater Trail starting September 1st, Friday. And we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about the City Council's discussion this afternoon at 2 o'clock. I guess people are going to be gathering at 1:30 down there. And they're going to be talking about extending the housing emergency declaration, which Mayor Hales declared last fall, winter. And also we'll be talking about the Terminal 1 shelter proposal and others. I titled this show, Housing and Houselessness, Community Self-Organization is the Only Solution. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I think I could explain what I mean by it. I don't know if you all agree with it or have similar ideas in mind. In parentheses, speculation and private profit are the problem. It's so easy to make these grand declarations on the radio and so difficult to actually fight for them in reality. But hopefully we'll get into talk about some of these broader political questions which are implied in that statement. But let's first talk about, since it's coming down so urgently and people are so directly affected by the proposed sweep, we all hate that term, of the people living on the Springwater Corridor. Amanda, you were on a couple weeks ago, and there was a lot of sort of momentum at the time, feeling that people were ready to stand up and hold the line on their camps living out there on the corridor. And a lot has happened in the past 2-3 weeks. So maybe we could talk about, first of all, how many people do you think have already moved or still living out there? Do you have any idea whatsoever?
I want to say probably a little over half have moved, but it is hard to put a number on that. And I haven't been able to keep track, nor a lot of the advocates out there, as to where people are going. They just kind of started trickling out. The area that I mainly serve, people are each day slowly moving out. The numbers are are getting smaller, but I don't see people being gone by tomorrow at all. So I think we're going to still see clusters of camps down the corridor.
Excuse me. I did say who Sarah and Austin are involved with. You're with Backpacks of Hope. Maybe you could just briefly talk about what that group is and what you all have been doing with the people out there.
Well, what we normally do is just take supplies and food, things to survive out there. We've kind of grown quite a bit since because of this emergency. We work side by side with other organizations. I mean, really, we're all kind of have come together and we're all on the same mission. I mean, I don't even really consider each of us small little groups anymore. We're just one big group of activists out there trying to help our community. But Backpacks of Hope has been out there finding locations for people to move, slowly taking them over there, providing moral support out there. I spend a lot of time having conversations with the residents on the corridor, trying to figure out what they want to do, how they're feeling. And as we're doing that, we're passing out tents, supplies, so when they do go to their new location, they can have a fresh start. So Backpacks of Hope has moved from passing out backpacks and survival gear to joining other organizations and helping keep the residents safe and moving. So,
Austin, maybe it could go to you or Sarah or Amanda to talk about just some of the, I guess, the general word politics, or, you know, what some of the issues were around what changed, if you want to talk about it, can talk about it, in the past couple weeks regarding the idea of a sort of a community resistance, the community of people living on the Springwater Corridor, and deciding that that really wasn't the thing to do, or that people weren't ready for that or whatever.
Sure, I can speak to that a little bit. So I got involved in the project because I heard from folks who were living out on the Springwater Corridor that they were interested in help organizing a Stand Your Ground action, because the eviction that is coming down on them, which is a term that I prefer to sweeps very much in this situation because they're clearly being evicted from their homes, was something they wanted to resist. But throughout the last 6 weeks, you know, we've done a lot of work out there, and a lot of people have showed a lot of enthusiasm at times. And then certain things happened on the trail that made it so that a collective strategy was no longer something that people really rallied behind. And so I've always been out on the trail really trying to figure out how I can help the folks who are out there and listen to their needs. And once that desire started to clearly be gone, we started reevaluating how we could support them.
And I think it's implied or stated in the title I gave, Housing and Houselessness, Community Self-Organization is the Only Solution, that, these issues that you're involved with Portland Tenants United, which started basically to fight on behalf of mainly renters to prevent evictions, to work for affordable housing, to work against these vicious rent increases that are going on. But obviously, maybe you could just explain how you felt the common cause. You see these as not separate issues.
Not at all. The people who are currently unhoused were at one point in their lives tenants, by and large. And so they are clearly part of our constituency as a tenants union. Also, a lot of us tenants are one rent check away from being out on the streets ourselves. And so, you know, the fact that these two things we're experiencing in this crisis are so often separated is one of our big problems. Because really, everyone needs housing in order to live a successful life. And if we want a productive and cooperative society, we want to provide housing for everyone, because that's going to be the first step.
Well, Sarah, let's bring you into the conversation. Obviously, people came to know about you as a mayoral candidate recently. You work with Portland State University. You work as an urban planner and a community activist. Sort of from a, you're obviously sort of straddle various worlds here. To the extent that you're sort of within the Portland city planning process or whatever, and talk about this issue. How are people viewing this issue from Portland? I mean, people must. It's really incredible the fact that there's just so many people out on the streets, and there's such the visibility is so dramatically increased in the past couple years. Obviously, with the housing emergency declaration, with devoting more funds to affordable housing, obviously the city's paying attention. Talk a little bit about how you see the city responding to this issue.
Well, it's funny because, you know, my day job at Portland State is to share Portland as a model city with cities from around the world. So, hey, do what we do, and then you can be green and sustainable like us. And it's gotten increasingly difficult in recent years, especially with the visibility of people sleeping out of doors. I shared an anecdote on my Facebook page the other day that was like a repost from 2011 when I had a delegation here from St. Petersburg, Russia. They were studying civic engagement, and they asked, "What is this, like an art installation? You know, what with all the folks making their beds?" And I didn't understand what they were asking me, and they're like, "Are these people like actually American citizens?" And they couldn't believe that this was our people that we were allowing to experience houselessness in our society. The idea was just anathema to them. And the fact that, you know, that was 5 years ago that I posted that, and the problem's been getting increasingly worse, and the fact that we fail to address our shared burden, I think, even as Portland continues to grow and continues to prosper and remains a darling internationally, especially with huge investors from Asia. What are we going to do to not necessarily staunch growth here? Because we do need a robust economy if we're expecting people to thrive and prosper here. But how do we capture that and make sure that it's equitably distributed across our population, and to make sure that a small handful of people aren't benefiting from intense growth here, and that others, a huge portion increasingly, are left behind? And that's something that I know that we attempted to do in our comprehensive plan update when we were thinking about ways of doing bonuses for affordable housing. But I still don't think that it's a priority for policymakers at this point in our city or state, for that matter, that housing is a human right, that housing should be a public good, just like safe roads and schools, that we need to understand that if we're going to house everyone here, we're going to have to go all in. And that's why I agree with Israel Baer that we should even stop talking about homelessness and start talking about housing crisis. This is a housing crisis. These folks need housing. And the fact that we're about to have a mass displacement on order of a refugee crisis in our city alone that boggles the mind is something we should be terribly ashamed of right now. We're moving hundreds of people out of a place where they've made a shanty town, a favela that we look at in places like Brazil and say, oh my God, look at that third world country. How can they do that to their people? And at the same time, we have that here, except instead of, you know, concrete, it's tin sheds and bushes. And so we're saying, don't stay in this home you've made. You need to leave, but sorry, there's no place for you to go.
Now, that kind of blows my mind what you just said about people from St. Petersburg, because, you know, I just want to remain with that a little bit, because the idea I have, you know, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, like the arrival of capitalism and the, you know, the breakdown of sort of a stable, guaranteed job, guaranteed apartment, sort of the idea you have is that like people were just thrown, you know, open or whatever. And so, but you're saying they don't have the kind of housing crisis in Russia that they do here.
Well, I don't know the state of affairs there, but I think the mindset of communism and probably the fact that they built all of the housing, public housing when they did, I'm not sure what their economy is like or what their housing situation was. The point being that these were not foreigners. These were not people who had washed up on our shores suddenly and needed our help. These were our own people that were having an internal diaspora. We're having an internal refugee crisis of our own. We can't even find housing for our own. So how are we supposed to accommodate the people fleeing from places like Syria? I mean, the world is in increasing chaos with climate change. We're going to be welcoming climate refugees in intense numbers here in the next several decades. Where will everyone go? We need to think very carefully about where everyone is going to go.
And you know, can the city, you know, can our municipal structures, can our state structures, can our federal structures, are they capable? That's why, you know, I provocatively put the community self-organization as the only solution. I do want to get into the subject of, you know, the only models that I see actually working from my privileged perspective of being a house person, living in a family-owned house, but that, you know, having visited Hazelnut Grove, places like that, you know, I mean, it's not something that can immediately be, you know, spread elsewhere because private property still reigns. But I mean, they seem to be like actual working communities, whereas the rest of our communities seem to be breaking down. So let's get into that. I want to put out the number 503-231-8187. We've been talking mainly about Springwater Corridor because there's evictions are imminent of what Amanda Reese of Backpacks of Hope, who's a guest here today, says maybe half the people are still out there, but there's people who aren't going to be moving out. So there are going to be people who are apparently going to be evicted. Are y'all calling for witnesses to just be there and, like, you know, do cop watching? What are the organizations calling for?
Absolutely, we're asking people to come support us and watch. Like Austin was saying, we had this plan in place a few weeks back when people were wanting to stand ground, and since then the plans have kind of changed. And back a few weeks ago, we did have people wanting to, observers and things like that, wanting to come out. When we got to the point where we realized we did not have the support from the community that we thought we had with the stand ground, we just started asking people from all over, organizations, residents from different neighborhoods have been coming in. We don't have like a real plan for tomorrow other than to show up as early as possible, gently help people get out. So as far as cop watch or any of that, I couldn't answer that. I don't know if anyone's coming out at this point. That was probably be something Austin could talk a little bit more about.
Yeah, so I've been in contact with the National Lawyers Guild, and there's going to be some legal observers out there tomorrow. And we've been trying to mobilize some people through a couple networks that have been set up throughout this year to sort of address sweeps. And we'll see. I mean, I think one of the big problems is that this is going to be what the mayor's office right now is saying, likely a month-long endeavor. And so mobilizing community members to make sure that the police are not passing on undue violence and trauma to folks out on the trail is going to be difficult for that long of a time. And so if you're listening out there, you know, I'm going to be out at Lambert Field at Southeast 83rd in Lambert tomorrow at about 6 a.m., just sort of watching people and filming the cops, and we'd love to have you out there. Remember that this is a peacekeeping thing. We're there to sort of help the folks on the trail get out in as peacefully a way as possible right now.
Well, let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, my name is Sunny. I want to thank all you people for doing as much as you can do about this situation, and more importantly, helping all these people. And I just wanted to say our youth across the nation seem to be dazed by technology and lethargic, but I do believe that the housing issue hits home with young people. They realize how precarious their situations are as students and mostly low-income workers and etc. And this problem is fixable. We need a purchase fee, like 2 cents tax on or fee on each purchase, because after all, people throw their pennies away. And I think if we rally the youth, the students, high school on up, and others attached to them, and say, why not? Come on, let's just try, you know, 2 cents per purchase of anything, and put that money together and start building the housing, because at this time, of course, the coast, some of the businesses are cutting back on their operation or closing down because they cannot get workers, because workers cannot afford to live there to work. And so some of the business element might be beginning to see the pinch, but the youth, I think, could be mobilized behind the idea of perhaps a 1 cent, 2 cent, whatever it takes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that comment.
Thank you.
And
I put in a plug there? Because sales tax is a heavy lift in Oregon, but folks can support the affordable housing bond measure that's going to be on the ballot in November. We do have something out to the voters right now to help support affordable housing. It's not a lot. It's about $260 million, but it'll get us about 1,300 units of the lowest income folks into housing potentially. So I don't know if a sales tax is going to work right now, but that's one way if folks want to have public taxation, they can invest in that.
So it's going to be a ballot measure this
November.
Ballot
measure. Yep, you vote yes on the affordable housing ballot measure.
Okay, well, let's just go right to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. It's George. And recently I was looking at Noam Chomsky's recent book, Who Rules the World? And on page 53, he says, real unemployment is at depression levels for much of the population. And I'm sure most of the KBOO staff would say that's totally credible. And what I'm wondering is, and I've heard often about how the center of political debate in the U.S. Has moved over the last, say, 40 or 50 years to the right. And I don't doubt that you and other talk show hosts would like to hear something like the St. Petersburg delegation saying, look, isn't it time for us to have a discussion around socializing the profits? But I don't know if there's anybody out there who could represent these issues who believes that, and I'm wondering, am I just not hearing something? Is it that when you look for people to discuss this issue, you find the people who are really well informed and are passionately for the houseless people are people who are cautious about saying anything farther to the left than we must have substantial reform, which sounds great, but I'm just wondering if...
Okay, well, let's take that question.
Yeah, thanks. So that's... I'll just hang up. Thanks so much,
Paul. All right.
Paul.
Yeah, thanks, George. the issue of profits and how we organize ourselves economically and socially are big questions. We're down to the people who are, most dramatically impacted, who weren't able to continue living in a house and are living out in tents and shacks out on the Springwater Corridor, are either had to move out or going to be evicted coming up really soon. And as a community, we weren't able to prevent that from happening. So it seems like groups like Portland Tenants United are valiantly attempting to organize marginalized people who are trying to hold on to their houses. The bigger political questions, how we can, dramatically transform this system we live in, I don't know. How do you get to that from, community organizing work? These are obviously difficult questions, but anybody want to tackle that question?
Well, I think we need to start by adding health to the system.
Adding what to the system?
Adding health to the system. And so that can take many different perspectives, right? But we need to start allowing people to have the space to, grow into productive beings. One of the perspectives that Portland Tenants United is taking right now is that tenants' rights are going to be one of the first things that are able to sort of stop this flow of people from evictions out into the streets and being unhoused. And so rent control and an end to no-cause evictions will do a lot to stop this growing population of people who are unhoused. But we also, of course, have to build housing and really think about how we use that housing and what our personal space looks like and how we can share it. Maybe we've gotten to a point where the idea of one person having their own single apartment is not a very realistic thing.
Or their own 6 or 10 room house.
Absolutely. So we really need to start pushing our imagination and our understanding of what is possible and what we need to survive. And really, you know, making those sacrifices for our own individual health, as long as that's able to be maintained still for the collective health.
Well, the people like to feel that something's happening, you know, that there's movement being made. So just for Portland Tenants United, give us a sense for, you know, what did you all start a couple years ago?
Yeah, it's been about 18 months since Portland Tenants United has been organizing.
So give us a sense. I mean, do you feel like it's moving? Do you feel like it's building?
Without a doubt. When we first started meeting, a lot of us in the room thought the idea of even talking about no-cause evictions was out of the park, and that, you know, that was going to be years before we really were able to make headway on that. And because the crisis is so bad in Portland right now, a lot of people have come together around these issues. And so the conversation has really changed in the last year and a half. And our local politicians are starting to realize that if they want to stay in office, they're going to have to start listening to these demands. And so we see a much more sympathetic tone taken for tenants' rights and tenants' issues across the city now. Also, a year ago, the only solution anyone wanted to talk about was supply-side solutions. And while we absolutely do need to build more, as long as we're building more luxury apartments and nothing else, we will do nothing to solve the problem. Because it is not people who can afford those high-end apartments that are being pushed out. And I work down in Northwest Portland, and you look around and a lot of those buildings are still largely vacant. Because even when people do have the money to afford those places, they're often going to choose a place that's slightly more affordable, because we're all, you know, hurting to some degree, and a little bit more money in our bank account every month goes a long way.
Well, you know, interesting. I just had this idea pop into my mind. Maybe Sarah, you can talk about this. When you're talking about that, you know, I see, you know, going up and down Ankeny, I see, you know, these big box things. I don't know. Obviously, I don't know how much they're. How much is it, like, those big box things average renting for? Do you have any idea?
I don't know what you mean by big
box. Those, you know, they're generally like 4 or 5 stories high, a block or half a block square. Those big new apartments, condos. I'm not sure exactly what they are, but there's like 3 of them on Ankeny Street riding here from east, and they're all over the place. You know, you can see them all over the southeast anyway, where I am.
Yeah, I mean, it's all market square. I mean, it's all market rate development. So those are going for whatever the market will bear. I think you're probably looking at $1,600 to $2,000 for a 1-bedroom, maybe a 2-bedroom, depending on where you're at. The larger question is, you know, there is demand for that housing here, and there are folks ready to supply it. The question is, how do we capture value so that that's not just people who are coming in building real estate in our city based on our city being a desirable place because of the community amenities that we all provide. So where's the value capture there? Where are we actually capturing that so those profits don't just go into the pockets of real estate developers, because they're in the business of building housing. That's what they do. But there are all kinds of impact fees, carbon impact fees, scaled impact fees, even in the absence of inclusionary zoning, that we could be applying on these. And there's no way you're going to slow down demand in Portland. I think a better question is, how do we increase the supply of this transitional housing for people who are on the corridor right now and experiencing houselessness before any the supply comes on board? Even if we do pass the bond measure in November, where do we go? And this is where I think the smaller scale intentional communities can really start to help us hit the mark. Things like Hazelnut Grove. When you're walking the corridor and you see the encampments, you already see the seeds of this there. How can we start to build economic capacity for people so they can have stable housing, make sure they have a place where they can lay their head at night, get up in the morning if they feel like they need to go to work or get the services that they need, that there's some housing stability there. I think the tiny home movement has its merits. I think repurposing the zombie homes into small intentional communities and co-housing communities, land banking, we need land. You want to talk about capitalism, it's who controls and owns the land. So we need to think in our city right now is, where's the land? And that's where I think these interstitial spaces, things left over from transportation projects, building projects where other developers don't want to go. There's all kinds of places where this, you know, these land inventories we can be doing. But what it is a lack of commitment, I think, on the part of our leadership to say this is what we value. So we're going to allocate this land for that. And we're going to make a commitment to making sure that people succeed here by giving them the resources they need to meet their own needs, not regulating them into what we want them to do, but giving them the means that they need, whether it's working with zoning codes, so making it easier for them to do things like composting toilets and not having to worry about all of the building codes, so they can have space to get back on their feet.
Yeah, the code seems to be always a big thing, because so many of those codes were actually passed to favor the large business interests. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, my name is Dave, and I just wanted to give you my perspective as somebody who's lived on the streets of Portland. And, you know, and I've been, you know, with Dignity Village and Right to Dream and Occupy Portland involved with them. And I can tell you the vast majority of people I met on the street were very decent people that were just trying the best they knew how to get by. But having said that, there is also a criminal element on the streets. And they are mostly addicted to drugs, and they tend to take advantage of the most vulnerable of the homeless population. And sometimes breaking up these camps are the best thing you can do for the people in those camps that are being taken advantage of. But there needs to be something, a safety net for them to fall back into. You know, and I think that's a really good idea, you know, with the sanctioned camps that are supported by the city, because they're self-policing and they keep the bad elements out. And there needs to be more of that, because, you know, you just can't keep shifting people around from place to place without any option for them. So, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, people need to think about that there is that element out there, and they need to be separated from the other people that are just trying their best to survive. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, people need to get help, whoever they are. I mean, you know, people aren't born bad or criminal.
It's true.
Anybody?
Yeah, I agree with what he was saying. Definitely within the houseless community, there are victims, you know, in those on the streets. They, just like us, they're trying to survive. They're forming small communities. Everyone, I mean, that's just kind of human nature. We come together. Right now, what we're trying to do is kind of take this tragic situation and turn it into something positive, and taking the bad elements out of the situation. Right now, we formed a few small little camps out of the Lintz neighborhood. These people are coming up with their own code of conduct. They are policing who comes into these camps. I am so tired. I can't even form since this is this morning. You guys left. Excuse me. We've all been out
fine.
There.
We're all. She's been out on the corridor days and days.
So I'm so tired this morning. I can't even think straight. But they're doing a really good job right now. They know who they want in there. They know who is going to be a. I totally lost my train of thought.
Well, you're saying that there's people who are going, you know, that I heard when I went to a couple meetings out there at Lambert Field, that you know, that was one of the ideas that people had already formed communities. I heard people who are living out there saying that, you know, one woman said she had, you know, she had left an abusive situation, and she had finally actually felt a sense of community for the, you know, the first time in, you know, a long time. And that's, you know, it's both in some ways tragic and also reassuring to hear that, you know, people are able to find that. And the fact that they have to find that completely outside of, you know, quote, normal society, maybe that's just the way things are. Maybe normal society is structured so that we can't find the help in the community that we need, which is something we need to think about. It's so easy, you know, I'm sure people who are listening to this, you know, like, like I listen to KBOO and other radio stations in my nice room, in my nice house. You know, it's like I can have the leisure to sort of think about it and, you know, think that I'm like tuned into something important, you know, but I'm doing it from a place, you know, that's a relatively easy. And it's like, I can sort of maintain that, that bubble around me, but you know, once you're thrust out of that bubble, you're sort of forced to actual, you know, deal with reality, deal with people on a, on a, on a real basis anyway. So I think it's, you know, I think that what I heard that people were actually doing that, you know, on the Springwater Corridor, other places, how to favor that, how to make that a more of an ongoing thing is the key. And so like, how did Hazelnut, how did Right to Dream 2 start? How did Dignity Village start? How did Hazelnut Village start? You know, it was, let's talk about that. It wasn't the city that like in their enlightened, you know, taking care, you know, idea of like taking care of the population. They didn't like make that happen. It was people made that happen.
Absolutely. I mean, I think all three of those projects really came to be through direct action, where people were told they didn't have access to certain things, and then they went and took them anyway, because they needed them to survive. And they knew that both the political and business interests were aligned against them and didn't take into consideration their needs, and so knew that just asking nicely was not going to be enough. And so really by setting up encampments that were successful models was the best way for them to hold that land, because they could show the city that and the, you know, population as a whole that if left up to their own devices, they could do it better than any politician. And I think that's one of the big things here in this conversation is we think about people who are experiencing houselessness as being powerless. Like, they don't have control of their destiny. And so we have to rely on politicians to make the decisions for what's best for them. And clearly, I think if our history relating to houselessness shows anything, is that the exact opposite is true. And we should be really empowering them to make decisions about how best to be experiencing homelessness, and then also how to move out of it.
Well, I want to go to another call. There have been people patiently waiting, but the issue we haven't really addressed is, so where are these people going? I mean, one of the demands that was made was, you know, no evictions until there's actual place. And the Portland was supposed to have a shelter already for like lots of people. Was there actually anything in place before these evictions start?
Does anybody see anything? Have you seen? No, I don't think there's anything. There's nowhere for folks to go. I mean, Amanda's working directly with them day in and day out, so she can speak to that.
Obviously, like I said before I started stumbling, we're slowly moving people out, trying to get them outside of the Lentz neighborhood to just kind of give Lentz kind of a little bit of a break and calm things down.
Because that's where the major concentration
is. Yeah. And they're moving to places, and you were talking about how did Hazelnut Grove and things like that form. Like Austin said, the people, the residents, the campers took over. Well, that's kind of what's happening now. I won't disclose locations where they're moving to for their safety, but I'm really proud to say that within this, like Lambert Fields moving to various places, forming these camps outside of the neighborhood, so far it's been going really good. But right now there is no plan in place as far as shelters and all that go. A lot of people, like, you know, do not want to go into shelters. They, you know, there's a very small percentage who have been willing to do that. So right now they're being dispersed. They're going all over. But the positive thing out of all of this is they are turning things around, taking control of their own lives. We're not doing that for them like we had been before. They're making their own choices. We're not telling them what they should and shouldn't do. And we had to learn that like the hard way over the last couple of months trying to help them. It just turned into, let's stop telling them what they should be doing, what they need to do. So they have taken over. They're doing a really good job.
Well, you just heard Amanda Reese of Backpacks of Hope and part of a coalition of groups actively working together on these issues. Austin Rose of Portland Tennis United and Sarah Iannarone, who's a urban planning expert, community activist, and a former mayoral candidate. And we are talking about housing and houselessness. Mainly been talking about Spring War Corridor, but we should talk about the what's coming up at City Council, because it's coming up today, this afternoon. So let's go to our next caller and then launch into that. Harry, you're on the air.
Greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. During the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the city of Portland and Multnomah County had 8 homeless camps, which they funded. And I'm wondering, maybe we need a ballot measure to fund homeless camps, maybe 6 or 8 of them, because Dignity Village and Right to Dream 2 has a 30-day waiting list. So all these people being forced out of the trail have really no place to go.
Except another camp, which is, again,
how these start doing these, which are police controlled. Maybe police can actually go through them and have a really safe homeless camps.
Well, you know, those Hoovervilles, we've got better community technology now, and I'm thinking one of the places where we're thinking wrong about this solutions, community-based solutions, is continuing to use the word encampments. What does it mean to get out of the way of people maximizing their human potential? You think about, you know, colonialist implications aside, there's this pioneering image of the covered wagon moves out west, a family's in there, they might winter over in a small thing. But why do these have to be temporary, even solutions? Why can't folks start out learning some basic construction? Maybe they do build a 200 square foot, you know, homestead. Maybe they are able to build on that. They've got solar panels. They're able to learn technologies and appropriate sustainable technologies with very, very low carbon footprints, and start to make investments in a place. They plant a garden. They build communities. You know, when affluent people do this, we call it, you know, social innovation. But what does that mean for us to think about this in terms when we're making investments? How can we do, you know, the city can be helping, you know, communities find land acquisition and make them able to rent land and things like that, so they can plant roses, as it were, just like most people want to do. But it doesn't necessarily mean the single family home McMansion on a cul-de-sac. We might have to re-envision, you know, past our bourgeois aspirations of the Home Depot, you know, picket fence out front, what that's going to look like, and shift that to the Portland kind of creative DIY ethos, in my opinion. I think there's a great opportunity in our housing challenge. Everything doesn't have to just be this cookie cutter, you know, market-driven construction. These can be communities that are retrofitting existing homes that used to have one family that now can have like 3 or 4 families in there.
Or when largely middle-class people get together like that, they call it co-housing.
Co-housing, yeah.
So we need to talk about what's going to go on, because this housing emergency declared by Mayor Hales, we can talk about what that meant, what it means. He sort of proposed kind of out of the blue a 3-year extension, which didn't go over real big. Now, I guess what's on the table is a 1-year extension, and people are going to be talking about it at City Council today. Anybody have anything to say about that?
Well, I certainly hope that they pass the extension. I mean, it would seem foolish to me that City Council wouldn't, considering they haven't done anything to address the problem in the last year that we've had the housing emergency. If the declaration of an emergency amounts to the same amount of work that's been put in the last year, I don't necessarily see a reason in passing it. You know, I think emergencies and crises like the one we're experiencing demand action. And that's something that we clearly haven't seen from our leaders in City Hall. And that's why, you know, the work that Amanda and Backpacks of Hope is doing is so inspiring to me. Because like you were talking about with community self-organization, when we look at what's happening in the Springwater Corridor, you know, 40 people are being rehoused in these already established organized camps. Several other organized camps are being created. And those are the only places where people being displaced from the Springwater Corridor are finding a home. And so the city, our politicians, are doing nothing for the problem here except exacerbating it by evicting these people. And the community is stepping up to create solutions. So if the city wants to keep not acting, then they need to just back off and let the community make real solutions happen.
But do y'all feel like it's a good, people should go out to the city council at 1:30 today and make their voices heard, see what's going on?
Well, of course. I mean, they should do that every Wednesday, frankly. But, you know, the state of emergency is basically licensed to break business as usual, to break the rules. That's why you put it in place, because business as usual under a state of emergency can't take place. And when you look at what's happening right now with the relocation of R2-D2 and the ruling that just came down from LUBA, the State Land Use Board of Appeals, saying they can't move over to Central East Side Industrial Area because of the industrial zoning, when you think about the conversations with T1 and the industrial zoning, well, maybe the state of emergency should take precedence. Where's our state of Oregon saying this is a housing crisis statewide? A good majority of Oregonians live inside the Portland metro area. We need to allow these temporary uses of industrial land. You know, taking them out of industrial supply for the long term may not be good for the economy, but taking them out of the supply for a year or so while we stabilize our housing market through emergency measures like temporary rent freezes, even, we should be taking opportunity in the state of emergency to really staunch the blood flow. I mean, our neighbors are just, the ones who aren't already houseless are on the verge of it. People are terrified. Folks are having, even my students at Portland State, they can't find places to live. So what are we going to do to even stabilize our community? That's why I think if we have a state of emergency, I agree with Austin, we should demand action, and we should demand intense, swift action. That's what the state of emergency is for.
So you're saying that here on the radio, who's listening in city government, in state government?
Well, I think the more and more we show up to city council meetings like today, the more and more people will be listening and understand that that action needs to be taken. You know, we really need to show these local politicians that it isn't business as usual anymore, because we're in the middle of a crisis, and we will, you know, enforce that. And so if they don't want to act on housing and don't want to act in a way that makes Portland the livable city for everyone that it should be, then they probably won't get elected again. And that's just the way things work.
Well, again, you're listening to a wide-ranging discussion on housing and houselessness here on Wednesday Talk Radio. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Jason. I'm with Rose City Backpacks of Hope as well. We've been working out there, I mean, tirelessly. And I'm just so proud of my team and all the houseless people for being proactive and finding new places and making these code of conducts. And I just want to remind everybody, the cold weather is coming, so we need donations. We need clothing. We need anything you could think of that you could survive out on the streets with. Tents. Every time you tear down a tent, it puts wear on that tent. There are tents out there with holes in them. We supply tarps. But we'd like to get some tents for these people. I would also like to, we need to find a place. We need to find places for all of our friends out here. And they are our friends. They are our family. And there are a lot of families out there on the trail that we take care of. I mean, generations of families that, I know a family that has four generations. They all lived in the same house, lost their home, and now live on the streets together, and now they're getting displaced. And some of them are getting, there's no room for anybody yet. And I would just like to call on the city to do something. I mean, we've been, I mean, yeah, this is, it's getting crazy. So let's, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. So let's yeah. give some addresses, where people can connect up and help with resources, money, supplies. The question of people's belongings, I know that was another demand, not to throw them away so that then people have to request even more donations and tap people out in the community who may all themselves not happen. Is there anything in place to make the city store them?
As far as I know, right now, one of the places and people that those on it in order for pass out, and this a huge problem we're facing. So we have been moving pins and apart, air and tear. These donations for when they find that part. Right now, you can do advocacy.com. That's through PayPal. Right now, that's how we're doing it. I don't know if any of the organizations.
I think there's going to be a fundraising effort underway in the next couple of days to try and get some especially traumatized domestic violence survivors who are disproportionately traumatized by the displacement and have a real hard time even going into a new unknown location to get them hotel rooms even for the next couple of weeks because the displacement is so traumatizing for them. And so maybe we can post that link on the Backpacks of Hope webpage, Facebook page too, when that goes up, probably a GoFundMe page or something like that, because we have some people for whom it's not just the inconvenience of this. This is severely traumatizing, especially for people who are experiencing violence, a history of violence, and have been displaced.
Let's go to our last caller here. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello. I wanted to ask a question. I've been watching or hearing a lot about this homeless situation, but I've never had anybody, I've never heard anybody talk about the property tax factor that drives up, that is a big part of owning property. I think we have the highest property taxes, you know, pretty much on the West Coast, but you know, a long time ago, I think they started the Pearl District, you know, with that other mayor, Vera Katz, you know, giving property tax breaks to the rich, which kind of, you know, started, you know, a building revolution, kind of. But I noticed that the government, the local governments, and nobody really talks about property taxes, and there's a lot of things that drives property taxes, you know, like the public employee retirement underfunding. Anyway, I just wanted to make that note that nobody talks about that.
Okay, well, thank you. We're just out of time here, so thank you for that comment, Sarah.
I was going to say, you know, that first caller, you're all on the right page, which is where are the resources? How are we as a society going to say we value these things? We don't have a sales tax, so our tax model is a two-legged stool of income and property taxes. And in fact, a lot of people who have long-time homeowners are getting displaced into houselessness because they can't afford the rises in their property taxes. So we even need to think about things like property tax abatement based on land tenure and things like that in North Portland, especially, where you've got long-time homeowners being pushed out because their property values are rising so quickly. But we need to think about that and think carefully is how are we going to pay for these things in the long term as a city, county, region, and state? Because it's essential. If we value it and we value it as a public good, we're going to have to come together and pay for it.
Well, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts here before we wind down? Austin, Amanda? Well, again, Backpacks, Rose City Backpacks of Hope Facebook page, and advocacy5 all spelled out at gmail.com, and I will put these links, and hopefully Sarah will get the information. If there is a fundraising effort, I'll have it on my page here for my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio here at KBOO.FM. Terminal 5, you're going to go to a meeting this morning. I understand we haven't
terminal
had any.
Terminal 1.
Terminal 1, I'm sorry. Advocacy 5, Terminal 1. No time to talk about that, but hopefully we'll get a chance. So you said you're sort of inclined maybe to look at it more positively. You were against it?
Well, I don't know if y'all felt the cold last night, but it was chilly. And, you know, I don't say I support $100 million Texas-style transitional facility at this point in time, but I sure do support us finding every viable place for people to go where they're not going to be criminalized for being impoverished and houseless. So if we can find a landing pad for people, even if it is 100,000 square foot structure where they can stay dry and warm, then I'm definitely into looking into that.
Okay. Well, thank all of you, Sarah Ann Arone, Austin Rose and Amanda Reese. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it. Coming up this Friday, September 2nd, Leonard Peltier Freedom Rally, one of the longest held political prisoners in the United States, 10:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square this Friday. At 2 p.m., there will be a meal served. There'll be guest speakers and drums. Thank you all so much for listening. Come out to the City Hall today, 1:30 p.m., talk about this houseless issue. Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland, thanks for listening.